Hello, this is John Case, and you're listening to the Talking Socialism show broadcast at 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday, April the 10th, 2020. And we plan on keeping this going on each Friday at 9 a.m. on Enlightened Radio, which you can reach at www.enlightenradio.org. There's a player at the top of the page.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mikey.
So we got some of our cohorts from our old radio station here on the air here, Carl, which is J.B. Christensen, who is on my screen, is right above your head.
I see him.
And he's a retired Marine engineer and part of our labor council here in the Eastern Panhandle, and a solar activist, and you know, a guy that actually, you know, puts all the panels on your roof and makes it so and he drives an electric car around town, so he's
God's work.
Yeah, he's doing God's work. That's right. Yeah.
It's so easy, though. It's too simple.
And my good friend Mike Diesel, who is a professional comedian, he's, like I said, he's coming through some kind of filtered screen where he looks like he's out of a 19th century daguerreaut print, you know, like they took photographs of Lincoln like that, you know, sometime. But anyway. Okay. And we're later in the show, we're going to have Ted Bettner on, who's going to explain. After we talk about China a little bit, and Carl, the thought is that, you know, there was supposed to be an $83 billion investment by China in the West Virginia related to the chemicals, the gas, all kinds of things, right? And then Trump started his trade war,
right,
with China, and this big meeting they were going to have with all these industries in China that China was supposed to come to, they canceled. China didn't come. They just said, right, we're not coming anymore. At which point, silence reigned over the entire project, right? Because, $84 billion is bigger than the GDP of West Virginia, okay? Just to give you an idea of what the size would be for the state, you know. But
well, you can't piss in your partner's soup.
It turns out, well, I don't know about that.
That's good urine, Dan.
Now, Carl, I negotiated with a paper mill company one time, you know, when the company said, they kept saying, we're only putting a little bit into the river.
Right.
We're only putting a little. And this big guy with a cigar, he was the perfect, you know, like cartoon of a boss, okay? And, you know, we're only putting a little bit. And so the chief steward in the shop, he got up and says, let me go refresh your coffee. And he picks up the boss's coffee and he heads out of the room. His own. He comes back with two full coffee cups. And he says, I only peed in it a little bit. right, you know. So at which point we had to stop the discussion about environments in the paper mill, you know. But anyway, yeah. So, and that Ted's going to talk about, he's a former research director, right? Am I right, JB, for West Virginia Budget and Policy? But he's on a new career,
right,
of some kind. He's going to work for... what's the great outfit? ProPublica, I think, yeah. You know, and anyway, he's been researching West Virginia economics for a long time, and maybe he'll tell us what's going to happen to the $83 billion.
I get their news alerts. They're good.
You know, and then...
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's going to be working for ProPublica. We should let him say...
Yeah, we'll ask him. Ask him, you know.
But his main thing was he didn't want to be the boss.
Right.
Of the Center on Budget Policy, because he didn't like firing people.
Yeah, to hire and fire people, you know? Especially in the pandemic.
Yeah, he didn't like that. Yeah, so.
I know.
He's probably going to stick on as an analyst.
Right. And then I think Dr. McGill, Zaki McGill, used to be host of our health and welfare show we used to have on Wednesdays in Shepherdstown. And he has been making a lot of trips to Cuba in the past 2 years, I think mainly because he has a partner down there. In the meantime, he's learned an immense amount about Cuban medicine, and he practices it himself. He's a psychiatrist, and he's been involved in, I think, creating the San Francisco program for the homeless that was instituted about 15, 20 years ago, and he's had quite a career. So I think he'll be joining us on that as well. I listened to a call last night on the by the Cuban American Normalization Committee. I'm not quite sure who they are, but they did have the ambassador from Cuba to the U.S. on the program, so it must be pretty legitimate. Anyway, so, but very interesting information on that as well. And then lastly, I'd hope that the people on the show will weigh in on Bernie Sanders' decision to abandon his put it in suspension, his presidential campaign. And, you know, what people's reaction to that. I see a lot of stuff out there on the web, but, you know.
There's Zaki.
There's Zaki.
Hey, good morning, fellas. I'm just momentarily getting the girls situated.
Oh, that's okay. We're gonna hear from Carl first, and then we're gonna come to you. So just tune in as you wish. I was just introducing you. I hope I got half of it accurate, but
The one thing you missed, John, was that he's also our local president of the NAACP.
Yes, he is. That's true. That's right. You know. He tried to be on the. We tried to get him on the county council, but
that's
he
right.
He came close. He did very well.
There was a conspiracy of some sort, you know.
A conspiracy.
No. Only 44% of Democratic voters showed up.
Okay.
That'll do it.
My mark was 11,000 right. to her 18,000. You know, we could have done that.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so let me just do one thing here before we get going.
I'm going to mute for right now, okay?
That's good. That's if everybody would, we're going to have, I'm going to play a little thing that Carl sent me, which is beautiful, actually, opening to this discussion of China. And, of course, my own interest in it is primarily is what are the connections between Chinese socialism and American democratic socialism? And is there... You know, and we talk about it, how far apart are those things? And that'd be an interesting kind of, that's my own angle. I'm sure Carl has his own. He's been studying this for years. But I think we're going to, let me just start recording this like that. And want me to just start out playing your clip there, Carl?
Oh, let it rip.
Okay, let me get the, make sure I'm sharing that part of the screen here.
Hey, Mike, you feel funny because you don't have a headphone on?
Yeah. but JB, I feel funny all the time.
Okay, so here we go.
According to the Daily Mail, across China, wet markets are reopening.
These wet markets are gross.
I think they should shut down those things right away.
They're just absolutely disgusting, selling exotic animals.
That's a place where consumers buy the meat of wild animals to eat, including bats.
So let's go to a wet market, I guess. This is probably going to be a little bit different than many of the other kind of like... you know, shock videos that you'll see on Facebook or whatever. This is basically just a normal run-of-the-mill neighborhood wet market. I just kind of wanted to share the actual reality of the situation instead of this kind of weird, twisted version that seems to be going around online. So, okay, so first I just kind of want to talk definitions real quick. So what is a wet market? This comes from Hong Kong English, which ends up coming from the original Cantonese, where you would have things that are dried goods, ganhuo. So stuff like ganhuo would be things like, dried seafood, would be things like canned goods, and those would be things that would be in like the ganhuo section of a market. Stuff that isn't dried goods is sold in a wet market. So that would be stuff like fresh produce, fresh meats, this kind of thing. So in some ways, your local farmer's market would be considered a wet market here. So, you know, for example, like you can get all different kinds of fruit and vegetable and meat. And like, honestly, if you're somebody that loves food, these are just awesome places to walk around, hang out, buy stuff. They're all shipped fresh every day from farms. And they're honestly one of the great things about living in China.
All kinds of tofu products, including tofu puffs. My favorite thing. Oh, jafu ju. Maybe jafu ju is my favorite thing.
Okay, so hygiene standards. This is honestly going to vary wildly from wet market to wet market. If you go to like a wet market in Hong Kong nowadays, you know, the hygiene standards are, they're pretty good. It's, you know, it's, maybe it's not quite as nice as going into a Whole Foods, but, you know, it's within that category. Within mainland China, it's really going to depend on the market. What I would say for this one that you're looking at right now, I would call this about average, maybe slightly above average. They do a pretty decent job here, but what you're seeing isn't necessarily out of the ordinary. So I can already start to feel you getting a little bit antsy. You might be thinking, what? It's a Chinese wet market. Where are all of the exotic live wild animals? Where are all the bats? But you see, that's the frustrating bit. That's the reality of the situation, is that most markets don't have anything to do with exotic live wild animals. They're just markets that's the same as your farmer's market, a little bit dirtier, a little bit more variety, and they always have fresh meat. Here's the point. I know that people are scared right now. It's a scary time, and during scary times, people want scapegoats. But this is a wet market right here. It's a normal wet market, and there's no bats, there's no pangolins. It's just a place where people shop. So yelling on social media that it's open, like it's some kind of like terrible thing, is just disconnected from reality. So I think especially during these kinds of times, it's important for us to keep that connection to reality, because there's people out there that want to manipulate you.
Well, hold on, let me stop that particular share so we can get my screen back here. Okay, I guess we're all back. Carl.
Yeah.
Okay, so why did you send me this this clip? Why don't we start with that?
For two reasons. One, you know, I argue with a lot of Trump, the Trump sector of the working class around here all the time, and one of the things that they always throw me is what's so terrible about why this virus thing started is because of, you know, everybody in China eating dogs and bats and so on. So I can argue with them all the time that, you know, I've been to China three times. The oddest thing I ever saw or ate was what was called a sea cucumber, which I ate once. It was kind of slimy, and that was it. Otherwise, the Chinese eat the same things we do, except that they spice them and cook them much better. But so I thought that was good. It showed the reality of what really goes on in the so-called Chinese wet market. You know, it's not that, I'm not saying that these strange markets for these strange wild animals don't exist, but they're extremely tiny, and they're usually for a privileged elite.
Yeah.
Across Asia, who has a taste for these sort of things. And China itself is shutting down a lot of them. But the most interesting thing, why I picked that, is that a lot of people think that China is starving to death, and that socialism doesn't work, and there's empty shelves in markets and so on. And so I picked that because it gives you a feel of the actual abundance of good food. The average Chinese worker probably eats healthier cuisine than you and I do.
What's the, do they import a lot of it, or is it mostly homegrown, and how do they get that? The cities are huge, right? So,
well, you know, just about every piece of land in China is utilized. They have a much smaller degree of arable land than we do. But you don't find lawns in China.
Yeah.
Anybody with any patch of earth next to their house, it's a garden. It's growing vegetables. Right. And all of it is made use of. One thing it means is that a lot of people get their food through these small markets, which are brought in from local farms and local produce and so on. And they buy it and they shop daily. and buy at the relatively low prices. And so this is the way most of the Chinese eat.
Do most people drive cars to their grocery store, or do they have to walk?
No, they walk. They're all in their neighborhoods. Or maybe they ride a bicycle or a motorbike or something. But most people in China don't have cars, although a growing number do. They do import some things, like they import wheat and soybeans. Those are, for northern China especially, eats more wheat than the rest of the rest of China does, and soybeans are eaten everywhere, China imports those, and it saves them from using the little arable land that they have in order to produce these fresh produce. So right. It works out rather well.
You know, I was years ago, I think when my wife first went to graduate school in economics. I think Danny Roderick had just published he had a collection of essays, including a number of Chinese economists translated into English, about trying to explain the miracle of Chinese development, and because it was the fastest growing, longest sustained economic growth, I think. I mean, there's probably some time in history when there was something better, but you're not affecting as many people for sure. And the interesting thing was that when the revolution took place, almost overwhelmingly in 1949, overwhelmingly most of the peasants and people in China were engaged in agriculture, and you had an agrarian, really, a revolution against this, ancient regime that, collapsed basically under the Japanese invasion. Okay. So when the leadership formed this ideal, there's a lot of idealistic, communistic, you might say, ideals about how agriculture collectively or communally could be done that were inspiring to the peasants, especially. And, when it actually turned into national economic policy, it didn't work out quite as expected. But
my view on all of that is that you take classical Marxism, and it has very little to say, almost nothing to say about how you take a country where the vast majority of the people are peasants and turn it into socialism.
Very little.
There's nothing there. So what, like when Stalin finally got the reins in the Soviet Union, he had no classical Marxism, so he just made shit up. He just made it all. He figured, he was a class struggle guy, so he decided to wage class struggle in the countryside and based his policy on it. He just made it up. He sucked it out of his thumb.
Right. If you don't give me food, I'll kill you.
Exactly. Well, that's how it started. And you could make a case that Soviet agriculture has never recovered since.
I don't think it has.
It's not like there's some correct line on agriculture and how to deal with this. And China was even more so. Mao, who was brilliant and absolutely brilliant up to 1949 in waging the struggle and recovering from all the stupid ultra-left lines in 1927 and then finally taking power in 1949, was absolutely brilliant. But afterwards, he was just making shit up too. The Great Leap Forward turned out, with the backyard steel mills, people were melting down
hose
and picks to make pig iron. I mean, it was just, another case of making shit up.
Right.
The only Marxist theoretician who had any good sense on the question somewhat was Bukharin.
On agriculture, you're talking about.
Yeah, on agriculture, on the peasantry and extending the NEP, Stalin put a bullet in his head.
No, they didn't want to have that. But speaking of the
get to China, when they first started out, they had these, and I visited these when I was there. They had these people's communes. The idea of taking peasant co-ops.
The late '60s.
I was there in in 76, 79, and 80.
Okay.
All 81.
Right. Yeah.
So I saw it under the Gang of Four, when the gang had just, you know, the transition period. And then after the Gang of Four had been overthrown, the last time that I was there, was every communist official I met was an ex-con. They were all just released from jail.
Wasn't that true of Deng Xiaoping?
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Deng Xiaoping was busted busted three times. And when he finally came back, it was because of, you know, Mao, one of the last decisions Mao ever made was to bring him back, because Lin Biao, who's head of the army, had tried a coup against him, and so all of his guys were gone. And the leadership of the army hated the Gang of Four. And so he had no one to run the army. And so without that, there would be civil war. So he brought Deng Xiaoping back for the last time and put him in charge. And so it was Deng and a combination of Deng and Zhou Enlai that saved China from civil war. So Deng took a different approach. When Mao had busted him, he was in a tractor factory. And the first thing he did when he got there was he organized a bunch of workers to go through all the classics of Marxism with him. So they studied Marxism in their tractor factory. And so Deng Xiaoping is actually a very good Marxist. Most people denounce him, and I find out most people never read a goddamn word he read, that he ever wrote. But he's actually pretty good. And what he did is he took some of Bukharin's ideas and applied them to Chinese conditions. And he saw that in order to create the socialized production, after where socialism gets its name from what? From large-scale socialized production. So the question is, how are you going to make socialized production? Well, he had a little bit. They had some state-owned factories. But he wanted to do it quick and in a large way. So first, you know, he let the peasants make profits off the land that they worked. Land was all owned by the state anyway. Every piece of land in China is owned by the government. And they just unleashed the law of value, the market. So when, he took and made official what already existed irregularly, and he called it the socialism with Chinese characteristics, which is socialist market economy, which means that it's a class society, but you have three forms of ownership. You have state or public ownership, you have cooperative ownership, and you have private ownership, private capital. So Deng brought the capitalists in a big way, not only unleashed some small ones in China, but he brought in the foreign ones, because he wanted to create socialized production and do it fast. And, you know, it's interesting, the comments you made about earlier from the friend of yours about China's, you know, growth decade after decade. There's an article written by an old China hand. I think he's still living in China. And he wrote it sort of tongue-in-cheek with the title, Deng Xiaoping is the world's greatest political economist.
He might be.
And he did. He compared him with, you know, so the article compared, said, well, Keynes, we can say Keynes inspired FDR and the New Deal. He says, what Deng Xiaoping has done makes the New Deal look like peanuts.
He was influenced by Arthur Lewis, you know, the Jamaican international economist who got a Nobel Prize in I think, early 50s.
He emancipated his mind, and he encouraged everybody else to do it also, and to seek truth from facts and to get a non-dogmatic form of Marxism going. And so China today is exactly what it says it is. It's the country at the entry stage of socialism. It has a socialist market economy. It has Chinese characteristics. Some people say, well, what are Chinese characteristics? My reply is, one of them is this country is run by the Chinese Communist Party of 880 million members, and don't you ever forget it. That's what Chinese characteristics are. So capital exists in China. State capitalism exists in China. Regular capitalism exists in China. But it's ruled. Capital is ruled in China. Capital does not rule China. And that's something new under the sun in a big way. And it means the Chinese Communist Party is riding a tiger. It's riding the tiger of the law of value. And so far, so good.
One of the most interesting aspects of Roderick's research was that how industrialization took place on a smaller scale. Towns that had, which had been where communes had been formed, okay,
right,
were converted into basically town privately funded and partially owned enterprises that, in which the township or the province always had a public stake.
Right.
Okay. So this idea that
a lot of hybrids.
Yeah, a hybrid corporation, really. You know, it's like a big company that in which the government had a public stake. We see that, and in some ways that was the engine that allowed this mix of private enterprise supervised by some political and public entity, right, or at least influence, and the public entity deriving its income from in part its stake in these enterprises, okay, so that it had an incentive for them to make money in order to increase the ability to provide public goods. And so I think that that there's a lesson there, and the lesson to me, in a way, for the United States is that we're about to see, you know, about 10, 20, 50,000 bankruptcies.
Right.
Yeah.
In the United States.
How about capitalism with a conscience?
You know?
I agree. And an interesting idea would be let all those big corporations let their stock go down to penny stock status, buy it all up, and turn it over to the unions and their allies to run as worker co-ops. That's what I would
support. Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, we'll see whether that. But I think the initial idea was that, you know, if you had a super Chapter 11. This was Stiglitz's idea. If you had a super Chapter 11, because one bankruptcy, if you do them one at a time, there's going to be like a domino effect. You know, one guy's debts is another guy's assets, right? And our customers and all this. So why not have a super Chapter 11, okay, in which you reorganize, you know, these 10, 15, 50,000 failed corporations, right? And you'll find somewhere in there the too big to fail scenario, in which now it becomes completely appropriate to say, okay, if we're going to bail out the too big to fail, why don't we have a stake in them? Yeah. I mean, that's an argument I think that'll be compelling now. And the other question I want to ask you, Carl, as what's the difference between too big to fail and the commanding heights?
Well, some of the commanding heights are actually important, you know. And they actually create, or they're institutions or enterprises that create new wealth. Whereas many of the too big to fail are just speculation. They don't really create new wealth. They gamble on, any of the big hedge funds, you know, they gamble on whether, say, the price of the yen goes up or down in the next hour, you know. So they make money, but they don't create new value. So I would say just let those ones fade away. But we can save the ones that are too big to fail that actually create wealth, real wealth, and that we can take a 51% stake in the ownership of it for our troubles.
You probably don't even need 51%.
I know, you could probably run it with 35%.
You know, I mean, and it would, and of course, I mean, you're going to assume, you assume risk too, in a sense, when you take control of something like that. I mean, but on the United States, so we have, how about socialism with American characteristics? It's one of the things I like about the expression socialism with Chinese characteristics, is that every country, you know, how public goods and public interests get power over all these other, you know, ancient historical things, right, that hold people back or that make it so, you know, what about American characteristics?
I think that phrase applies to every country in the world. That's very important. And, you know, it's interesting in a way, the first one to raise it was Browder.
For those who don't know, the chairman of the Communist Party in the during the war years.
Its biggest and most successful period.
Right.
Problem with Browder is he asked the right questions, but he came up with piss poor answers. They weren't all that well. I was like, good. So he was sort of left out in the cold. But
the whole thing was pretty much smashed, pal.
Right. He saw himself as kind of America's Tito. But in any case, yeah, socialism, the American characteristics were, first of all, it would be a socialism that understood that there is such a thing as natural human right.
Yes.
You know, there's one phrase in Lenin. I did this long. I don't call myself a Marxist Leninist anymore, but I like Lenin, and I did a long study of him. But he had one phrase in there that stopped me cold. He said, "Socialism is dictatorship. Proletariat is the unrestricted power of the working class." I thought a minute. I said, "Wait a minute." I said, There's nothing in the universe that's unrestricted or without limits. So the proletarian dictatorship has to have limits. I don't care what Lenin says, it has limits. So what are the limits? So I thought it over for a long time. And I finally came to the conclusion that the limit was natural human right. That's the limit. And that's a very American idea.
But
you'll find it in the last three words of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution as to where sovereignty lies. Most people remember the Constitution as, the 10th Amendment of states' rights, reactionary. But the last three words are, or to the people themselves.
But that's
in other words, it says, where does sovereignty reside? And what makes American democracy and what will make American socialism unique is that it understands that sovereignty resides in the people, not in the state. That we are more in the tradition of John Locke than we are in the tradition of Rousseau. It's one of the reasons why in France, it's considered un-French and illegal for a girl to wear the hijab in school. It's just against the Rousseauian idea of being nationalized as a person. Whereas in our country, because we're Lockeans by instinct.
John Locke. Well,
who cares? Who cares if a girl wears a hijab?
But it's partly historical determined, right? I mean,
It's part of our American characteristics. So socialism in the United States will have this. I also think we'll be a multi-party socialism. Americans don't like elections where people can't lose, or that the party can't be voted out. So I think American characteristics. I don't think we'll have a single party, so I think we'll have a multi-party, and we'll be ruled by a changing coalition, of popular democratic parties, but there'll be other parties as well, as long as they obey the Constitution.
Well, we've had a
fascist or something like that.
I mean, we had to have a civil war to get the democracy that we envision now.
Right. And there's a lot of positive lessons from old Thaddeus Stevens. He was one of our early revolutionaries.
Let me open the discussion here to everybody else here. I think everyone's unmuted here. We got, I think I introduced everybody but Carl before, so Carl goes way back in the socialist movement in the United States, and I first remember him from SDS years, and I think he was editing The Guardian, New York publication for a while too, if
news
I'm not
editor,
mistaken.
News editor. I was acting managed and editor for.
Oh, okay. I remember seeing your name on a bunch of the articles and
right. Eight years.
Our
glory days.
Depending on what city you're in, it was in Buffalo, New York. It was called Indictment Days. Anyway, we're. He's been active in a lot of socialist organizations. He's been writing for 30 years or 40 years at least, and traveled around, and he's argued with everybody, including himself. And like most of us on the left has, you know. Well, you go through a period, you say, well, that was okay, but it didn't really do what we thought it ought to do, and then you go to something else. And so anyway, so those of you who don't know Carl, he's well read on nearly every subject, and like any street time, working class debater, he can get up on the street corner and behind a bullhorn and get it done. All right. Anybody else want to weigh in on this or ask questions? Or
I think JB's still muted.
I'm okay now.
All right.
Yeah, I muted myself.
Okay. Anyway, so socialism with American characteristics, guys.
Well, yeah, John. You and I had discussed a while ago redefining the definition of corporation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, not only that, but taking it even further, and what is really necessary for that human cultural existence? What is necessary? What's necessary is travel. What's necessary is energy. What's necessary is money. There's a lot of things out there that,
right,
that could be nationalized that I think we have this instinct in our country by some of these devout capitalists to talk about extreme profiteering. You know, this idea of unfettered capitalism will solve everything, which I think we all can agree at this point is bullshit.
Right.
Yes, we're facing one of those little failures right now. That's for sure. Hey, Zaki, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, John.
Can you?
Good morning. Good morning, fellas.
Yeah, I spent.
I enjoyed that, Carl, very much. I've been to China only once, but I certainly enjoyed what you had to say and some of that history. I found China just astounding. I was not enthusiastic about going there, and then once I got there, I said, "What took me so long?" I mean, you just can't argue with, a country with, 1.5 billion people who are somehow making it work, more or less, especially coming from a country with 300 million that's making it work less. Than
less.
Us. Yeah.
Much less.
One thing to keep in mind, is China is not paradise and it's not run by angels.
Absolutely. But
having said that, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
I agree.
Well, my first trip to China was in 1982, mm-hmm. and I was on a ship, and we were in some backwards hole, and it was supposed to be 40 years since an American had been there. And wow. That's why I was very interested in what you had said, Carl, earlier, that most of your experience in China was prior to that. And I'm wondering, how did you get in?
Oh, I was head of a Guardian tour. That was the first trip in 76. And then second, I was a member of the what was called the Communist Party Marxist-Leninist, which was the pro-China party in the United States. And I went the second time as the head of a delegation of eight different Mao groups, the U.S. delegation of Marxist-Leninists, and the Chinese were trying to encourage us all to form a single party. And the last time I went was to a cadre school. A small group of us were sent over.
Oh, man, you are a mole. Jesus.
And we were trained in United Front work. So I got to study. The United Front was some of the masters of it. And The thing about my time in China that, you know, my mom asked me about what China was, you know. And I thought, Mom, it's like walking into the past and the future at the same time.
Yes, yes.
I said, the reality of most of China was poor peasants, people like my grandmother being working as beasts of burden the same way they had done 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. At the same time, in their village, they would have what they called a children's class, which was a daycare center, which was a sort of the advanced social relations, you know. So later on, I thought about this, backward productive forces versus advanced social relations. Who described that? as the main contradiction in China was Liu Shaoqi.
The 20s, right? Yeah.
The president. At the same time, Mao was the chairman. He was the president, Liu Shaoqi.
That's right. Right.
He was the number one capitalist rotor. Deng Xiaoping was number two.
I'm a capitalist rotor myself. So anyway, my
main point is that today, for the first time, 51% of the people in China are proletarians.
Hmm. Meaning working for wages.
Yes, they're wage workers. They might be migrant going from one factory to another. They might be steady steel workers in a Seidong factory, whatever. But for the first time in its history, a majority of Chinese people are.
So that, does that mean the balance are in agriculture still?
The people working in agriculture are a large minority, but the general trend is they're becoming more and more proletarianized, and like agriculture here, China's is becoming more and more mechanized.
But compared to here, we're 3%, under 2.5% involved in agriculture here.
Right. So China's got a long way to go to get to that. But if you want to build socialism, having 51% of your, having the majority of the country working
for wages, yeah.
It matters. It matters a great deal. Plus the fact that you've taken about 400 million people out of dire poverty and you've raised everybody's income. If the Chinese Communist Party, for all you want to say about its iron rule, enjoys what's called the mandate of heaven, which means they have...
That sounds like divine right.
It used to be.
that's the monarchy. That was the defense of monarchy that John Locke went against, I thought.
That's right. But it's what Gramsci meant by hegemony. And they rule mainly by persuasion, and the people generally support their rule. I think at the last public opinion poll that had some credibility was around 76%.
Yeah, the problem
was if Trump had the degree of popularity that the Chinese Communist Party had, he'd be in seventh heaven, you know. But that doesn't mean that there isn't struggle. There's probably 1,000 strikes going on in China right now. You know,
1,000. Wow.
He's not going to be in sixth heaven, fifth heaven, fourth heaven, third heaven. He's not going to be in any heaven.
Yeah, because it's the other way.
Yeah.
We're headed south. All the time.
And
they win some, they lose some.
Have you seen my ratings?
Class struggle continues.
I like the feet on the ground philosophies. I mean, I know that you can't see as far as if you're at the top of a pyramid, I suppose. But but you remember that old parable about the dying emperor who was going to send a message to is the neighboring kingdom, and he tells his messenger to take the message. It's his last wish and hope for peace. And so the messenger takes the message and heads out into the courtyard of the palace, and there are throngs of people, millions and millions and millions of people, you know, and he struggles for half of his life to get out of the courtyard and into the mountain, and then he has even more. He never gets there. But the problem with pyramids, right? I mean, and in these, you know, very hierarchical kinds of structures. But I mean, it comes out of Chinese. I mean, the Chinese idea of a going way back, the Confucian idea of a model government is that of a model family.
All right, Confucius is very big in China these days.
You know, I mean, the harmonious family is the goal. The harmonious country is the goal. Great harmony. You know,
Chinese people vote. Most people don't know that, but they vote in terms of hierarchy. You only vote for the next level up.
Yeah.
In other words, if
democratic centralism.
You'll vote for the village leader, and then all the village leaders they'll get together, and then they'll vote for the next guy up. And then you repeat that about 12 times, and you finally get to the central.
But speaking of American character, doesn't that violate, in a sense, you know, like part of the problem that happened in Wuhan, right, what happened in any big bureaucracy? I mean, I worked for Microsoft, and I was 11 layers between me and Bill Gates, okay?
Right.
And, you know, the stuff that happened in between in any big bureaucracy, you know, is it's weird. Okay, it gets weird. It did surprise me a bit that the local officials in Wuhan did not want to tell anybody upstairs how bad it was, okay?
Right. That's true. And they, and the, what a lot of people don't know is that their heads rolled later on once the scope of the thing did get out.
Yeah.
The top people, you know, threw out, God knows how many of them, I think about 50 or 60 of them,
got
dismissed for trying to do the cover-up. And so finally, when they got it on the right track. And the interesting thing is how tight, you know, Wuhan was. You think we have tight with all the stay-at-home shit in Wuhan? It was. I have a friend who lives there, American, and we communicate regularly. It was tight as a drum. You couldn't go outside of your house. If you went outside your house, you know, you'd have a cop on your ass unless you had. It was your turn to go for your weekly groceries or something like that.
Mike was reporting to me, I hadn't seen it, but the other day, that there's been a resurgence, that maybe they opened up too soon.
They're worried. They're keeping an eye on it.
Yeah.
Because, you know the viruses don't respect.
They don't play by the rules.
No.
Carl, this is Aki. I have a question.
Yeah.
Those that they found responsible for the cover-up in Wuhan, do you think they were jailed or executed?
No, I think they just lost their job. They were sent to work somewhere else.
Just lost their job?
Yeah. Mao Zedong wasn't big on executions. I mean, I'm not saying that, a lot didn't happen, but he had a quip one time. He said, don't be too quick to chop off people's heads. He says, history has shown it's difficult to put them back on.
Yeah, we might need that head. That's right.
He wasn't like Stalin, you know. It's, you know, Stalin just shot all of his main rivals. But
90% of his 90% of his leading committee there. Yes, you know, we're never China, found. Yeah,
it's
right.
Like China, you got sent out to a factory in a rural area, or sent to feed pigs or something like that. And then later on, if they changed their mind, they brought you back.
Hey, and you think that's the case, even if they were culpable in the deaths of so many?
Well, like I say, you know, there's some cases. You know, if you had what they call blood debts, then that's a different matter. And a lot of times, China has still has capital punishment, but they do it in a very interesting way. Not only do they take you out and shoot you, they take the bullet and they send it to your family with a bill, and they charge the family to pay the bill for the bullet.
Whoa. Wow.
So it's a matter of creating not only just, you know.
It's partly your fault.
Exactly.
Why are you related to this person?
Why did you let him do it?
And it's a question of social hegemony. And so they tried, sometimes, like I think one time there's a story in Shanghai after the revolution, they had all this problem with opium addiction. So they rounded up all the main drug dealers. Put them on trial in a football field and shot them. And then at the same time, they told every opium addict, you have 1 year to clean up your act.
Wow.
And we'll help you, and we'll help you find a job. But you have 1 year, to get rid of your opium habit, or you'll go the same way that what we did with these guys. So.
Interesting.
That's part of the revolutionary history. Che Guevara did the same thing in Cuba, you know. The people were ready to, there was a, settle all the blood debts and on the street.
Grievances.
Street justice. So
you killed my brother, I'm going to kill you.
So Che rounded up 600 of the worst of them and put them to the wall to show people that justice would be done, so they wouldn't have to take it into their own hands. And so now, Cuba's more or less, for all practical purposes, done away with capital punishment. But in the early days, in the revolutionary periods of upheaval, it's one of the tools on the table.
Hey, Zaki, can you? I tuned in last night to that conference on Cuban healthcare. Okay, although it was mostly a solidarity thing by a committee I really hadn't heard of, but the Cuban ambassador was present in the meeting, And he spent quite a bit of time talking about this, the drug interferon. What's it? That they have that
interferon alpha 2B.
Right. Yes. And that this that this drug has does not cure does not prevent it. You know, it's not a not a vaccine. He made it very clear, but it has been helpful and you and in treatment.
He
says the Chinese have indicated some success in combination with other things. It's used for all sorts of cancers and autoimmune diseases. Mm-hmm. So it's basically an immune modulator. It rallies the immune system. It's not an antibiotic or antiviral. It's actually used to boost the immune system. It was used with a lot of HIV people back in the day, you know, to sort of boost their immune system so it wouldn't collapse, but so far sort of reset the set point that the HIV virus had, you know, sunk the immune system too. So, yeah, so they're promoting that, but I've listened, you know, when you contacted me yesterday, I reached out to about a dozen Cubans there on the island now, one doctor, a couple of medical students, and some other clinicians, nurses, developmental psychologists. And so I got some of consistent information. And yes, they're all being told that there have been studies that show that this alpha interferon alpha 2B has some function possibly in helping people recover. Although, of course, like all these studies that are going on now, all these claims, you know, it's too soon to say, you know, emphatically or definitively whether that's it's going to help. Cuba is also promoting a homeopathic regimen that they're actually giving to all the vulnerable populations, the elderly people and the infants and pregnant women are all getting this thing that's called Provenjovir. And so I tried to look it up last night to see exactly what it is, but I can't get any other specific other than it's a homeopathic product that's been used for a number of years that apparently may have some prophylactic effect in helping the vulnerable population. So there, Cuba has already begun distributing that to all the vulnerable population. And the last thing I'll say is that the medical community, here's one benefit of whether you call it communist or socialism. The university, the medical students have emptied out. The medical students and doctors are fanning across every neighborhood in Cuba. Every day, they're knocking on doors, they're taking temperatures, they're identifying who's at risk, who needs to be isolated and quarantined, who needs to be taken to the hospital for observation. The last stats I have is that of yesterday, there were 550 confirmed cases, there are almost 2,000 suspected, 28 patients have recovered, and there have been 15 deaths. And they've just suspended all public transportation in Cuba.
Wow. Well, that's
we have to keep in mind.
They have a national health service, you know.
Exactly.
That's what we left. You know? Exactly. Everybody should watch Call the Midwife, you know, if you want to understand what a national health service means.
But even that can be overwhelmed and, exactly. Like, for example, as it is being now in the UK, I understand. And in that context, I want to echo one thing that the Cuban ambassador said, and that in this kind of context, the boycott, continuing the boycotts, which under Trump is very aggressive. Yeah. I mean, they're still trying to keep everybody in the world from if you buy anything from Cuba, you know, you're cut off from trade or something. Same with Venezuela in a way, okay, and with other or the whole trade wars he started with Europe and China, okay, all those things are going to impede the ability to recover. Okay, so there's that. We only got about 10 minutes left because I don't want this to go over an hour because otherwise YouTube starts to complain about the size of the file.
I want to continue to emphasize this point, John.
What?
Across our country, 1% or less people have been tested. 1%.
Right, that's right.
That's right.
We don't really know the actual numbers, which are in the millions.
Yes. That's true.
And I want to emphasize that, you know, the disproportionate number of people of color, African Americans, that are dying. 70% of the deaths in Louisiana are African Americans.
Yes.
41% in Michigan. 72% of the deaths in Chicago.
Yep.
It's like, wow, if there was ever a signal that we need nationalized health care for everyone, but especially for vulnerable populations who have all the other debilitating diseases that are not being managed, like hypertension and diabetes,
right.
This is the clarion call.
Absolutely, pal.
Right.
Well, that raises the question of, is this a socialist moment, and how are you guys reacting to the decision of Bernie Sanders to suspend his presidential campaign? I'd like to close, go around with that maybe one at a time. Go ahead, Carl.
I'm still on the ballot as a Bernie delegate, and our primary has been kicked to June. So we're still running. Bernie wants us all to run. Whether there'll be a convention or not is an interesting question. It may end up being a virtual convention. So we'll have to see. But I think the main thing is to follow Bernie's lead on this. He's actually doing a pretty good job of it. Our task is to expand the electorate, you know, register as many voters as we can, especially in key demographics. Have a huge cooperate with other forces to get a huge turnout to vote movement, and especially to emphasize a lot of the down ballot races, because in the end we don't transform the system from the top down. We have to do it from the bottom up. So that means we have to win elections in cities at the county level and at the state. Here in Western Pennsylvania, we have three young women who are DSA members who have been elected to the legislature. Right. We have to make sure they get reelected. So that's terrific. And then we got six DSA members on the Chicago City Council. We got to make sure they get reelected and add a few more. So those are our tasks. You know.
Anybody else?
Yeah, well, I think Bernie made the right decision. He's got his hands full in the Senate right now. This bailout, this response to the C-19 is just starting. I mean, we don't know the scope of it. We don't know the length of it, and this could stretch into many more months. And just the future being uncertain as it is, I thought Bernie really stepped up by stepping down to a point and going back to work as a senator, where he is very much needed. His voice is very much needed in that House. I mean, that Senate is abominable. I mean, we could have got rid of Trump back when this C-19 started, and they rejected it. I mean, to me, the Senate is culpable in all this.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah. First of all, let me say how great it is to see JV and to hear Zaki. Nice to see and hear you guys. Carl, very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Mike.
As far as Bernie goes, I did my best. I worked very hard. It was a difficult campaign. Everybody knows 1% is controlling everything. So our message continues.
That may be clear. Bravo.
That's good.
There you go, guys.
Very good. Very good.
Zaki.
Zaki.
Yeah, Mike, good seeing you, brother.
All right.
John, I just hope that Bernie and I got a ironclad agreement from Biden. That's my hope.
I think he did. I think he did. It came out today that he did. Yeah, okay. Yeah. He signed. Biden signed on to a lot of stuff, man.
Well, he signed on to the he did the what do you call it, the incremental version of Medicare for All. Well, we'll do 5 years at a time, which was, I think, Elizabeth Warren's idea at one point too, right? Her but yeah.
So you think Elizabeth is going to be the VP?
No, I predict not.
You don't? No.
She might be, but I think that's just my instinct.
I would
total intuition.
I think I'm more inclined to say it's going to be Senator Harris, but that's just
okay.
I think what's, I forget her name, but the governor of Michigan,
Wisconsin, Stacey Abrams.
Oh, right,
oh, Michigan. Yeah. Michigan.
The governor of Michigan has been named by Trump as that woman.
Yeah,
the well, the more reason to get her in there.
All the, yeah, that's, we mean, we need more of that.
Exactly. Anything to piss them off.
Anyway, well, listen, guys, we're at the hour point here, and I would like to terminate the program here, because that way, if it's under an hour, then it gets under the radar in YouTube, bye-bye, and Facebook. You know. So anyway, I want to thank Carl for joining us today, and we'll have this discussion. There's a lot to talk about, and we could go on for days, but we'll try to figure out a way to keep the talking socialism thing going on here on a weekly basis. Keep the fire that Bernie started here alive.
Yes.
And thank you, Carl, for weighing in. And
my pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
I'm stuck at home here. So,
okay. Thank you, Zaki, for the reports from Cuba are. We need to get more into that a little bit. You know, it's there's so much to be learned there, that
fascinating stuff going on there.
Yeah, the trials that they have had and yet maintain their national unity or appear to is something to think about. It violates.
They've sent 600 doctors to 16 countries. How many doctors have we sent anywhere?
Yeah,
right. Anyway, JB,
take care.
All right.
You, Carl.
All right, buddy. Solidarity forever. Talk to you later.
All right, man. Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.